Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Turfgrass Epistemology. Hope everybody's doing well today. It's February 13th, 2024. It's going to be a nice day in Lexington. It's going to get up into 70, like low 70s, I think. It's going to be very nice. We're going to be having dinner on the deck tonight. Going to be outside playing in the grass. Going to be talking about grass. This is Turfgrass Epistemology, where we try to find how we know what we know about turfgrass science. Wayne, good morning. Gray Fox, good morning. Internet Surfer. I don't recall that one, but says you brought your pencil. Give you something to write on. Maybe I can make like pads or something with Turfgrass Epistemology, like a Turfgrass Epistemology notepad or something, if y'all are so inclined. Randy from Bulgaria, good morning. Super TA. South Jersey. I always forget if South Jersey's the Devils, or is that the Fly? I mean, I always forget. North Jersey and South Jersey follow two different hockey teams, and I always forget. I think South Jersey is the Devils. I can't remember, though. Andrew Burris, good morning, everybody. Another day of learning. Really enjoying these. Well, thank you. Yes, I enjoy doing them. It's always fun. But I'm not neurally typical. I'm not neurotypical. I'm a little bit diverse. So I'll get to that at some point in the future. Turf Nerd Lawn Care. One of my best things about subscribing to YouTube Premium is being able to listen to Turfgrass Epistemology while I work. Yeah, what is YouTube Premium? I don't know what that is. I've seen that pop up. Like, occasionally it asks me to, like, do I want to start a trial on it or whatever? And I don't even know what I would get by doing that. So I haven't ever clicked it. Brady419, good morning. And CVO Hobo. I don't know what that is. That's a new one to me, too. CVO Hobo, good morning. Good morning to Transition Zone Guy. It's going to be a fun day today. We have a very easy article today. We have clipping returns. We have with and without potassium, with and without magnesium, with and without calcium. We have perennial ryegrass and Bermuda grass, 3 years. It's a very good study. So we're going to be talking about that today. The couple of housekeeping items before we get started is my Calendly.com /Travis Shattuck's consultations, which some of you have been taking advantage of. That price is going up in April from $50 to $100. So take advantage of that if you want to. But if you're a member of the channel in April, I'll open up memberships. And what I've done is I've structured it so that if you're going to do a Calendly appointment throughout the year, then there's really no point in not being a member, because the cost of the membership gives you a discount on the Calendly so that it ends up being the same price, basically. So there's, you know, take that in consideration if you're going to do a Calendly consultation, which, I don't know, 15 or 20 of you already have. Then you might just consider being a YouTube subscriber, and then you'll get a link to a different Calendly appointment that gives you it keeps it at the $50 price. And then I have a higher tier, which provides a little bit more interaction between us. We'll have a Zoom meeting if you want to. It'll give you access to that. And even in the higher tier, I've set it up to where the Calendly appointment is basically free. I have to charge something. Calendly won't let me do it for free, so I have to charge $1. So at the end of the day, if you're going to do a Calendly, you might as well just do the upper tier membership on my channel. Because it's going to be the same price as if you're not a member and you do a Calendly invite or Calendly appointment anyway. So consider that whenever it opens up. But this will be the last month for the Calendly stuff for the same price, and it'll go up for everybody that's not a member of the YouTube channel. So just keep that in mind. So Super TA says YouTube Premium is no ads, and you can turn off your screen. Oh, that's cool. I do listen to YouTube occasionally, and I notice I have to keep my phone on. If I turn it off, it'll turn off. I didn't know it allows for that. So it's kind of like a podcast. You can turn your screen off and you can still listen to it. Like, thanks for letting me know that, Super T. I didn't know that. And Randy says you're always afraid of the simple things. So So in April, my kids are on spring break, and then there's the eclipse. I think it's on April 8th, which is a major event in the United States. It's not going to happen again for several hundred years, I think, at least nothing to this degree, to this magnitude. And it's just west of Louisville, about 30 or 40 minutes, and it'll run from, say, parts of northern Oklahoma all the way up like through, I think it's like through Ohio. So I'll be off quite a bit in April for the spring break. I'll be taking a vacation down in Florida. And then with the eclipse happening on a Monday, I think it is, and there's all sorts of stuff going on in April. So it's going to be a little sporadic in April. So this will be March will be the last month that I'm on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday mornings and Thursday evenings. And then in April, when I come back, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the Monday morning show for members only. And then the Thursday evening show will be open to the public. And then I'll keep it that way, which gives me time to go back and re-edit all the videos. I have like 80 or 90 videos that people want to have like 5 or 10 minute clips from, just from the papers. So I need time to do that. So if I do two a day, if I have 90 papers I've gone over, I don't even know, it's somewhere around that number. If I do two a day for 5 days a week, you can do the math, it's going to take me several months to get through them all and re-edit them down so that, you know, you can watch it for 5 or 10 minutes and get a basic idea of what the paper concluded and so forth. So that's my intent of going to only 2 days a week. I'm cutting the shows in half, so I have time to catch up. And then after I catch up, I'll reconsider adding in more morning shows. And the morning shows will probably be for members only. Beyond, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But for sure, in April, the Monday morning show will be for members only. And then Wednesday or Thursday night will be open to everybody. So that's the plan. I keep getting this question. I don't really know why, but I'm going to address a question that I seem to, for some reason, keep getting. And that is, do I use MLSN? And I got the same question yesterday on Calendly, and probably four or five of you have asked that question over the last several months, or what I think about it and do I use it? The answer is I don't use it. I don't use the MLSN. For those of you who might not know, MLSN is the minimum level of sufficient nutrition or something like that, created by Wendy Lertner and Larry Stoll and Michael Woods years ago. And it has a minimum level of nutrients for the malic 3 extract for potassium, calcium, sulfur, magnesium. I think that's about it. Something else in there. I think calcium somewhere in there. And it provides, the concept is, you know, if you're at or above that number, then you're probably fine with, in terms of your nutrient requirements to turf grass. And the short and skinny of it is, if you have no idea what you're doing and you don't know anything about soil testing, but yet you're soil testing and applying nutrients, you're probably better off using the MLSN guidelines, because you're probably grossly over applying all these nutrients. And the MLS guideline is a good, like, what do you call it? Poster board, or a good advertising board on the highway of like numbers that you can easily remember, right? It's not particularly complicated. It's easy to remember. So like whatever the numbers are, 21 parts per million phosphorus and 37 parts per million potassium and so forth. They're easy to remember. It's a poster board, you know, easy to keep in mind. And if you follow those, if you're using normal interpretations on soil tests, particularly from commercial labs, you're probably grossly over applying nutrients. And if you follow MLSN, you're more than likely going to result in less money spent, same acceptable quality turf, and in some cases, probably better quality turf if you're over applying potassium and you're having problems. So in general, for the average person, you're probably better using it than the existing interpretation, assuming the existing interpretation wasn't conducted on turf grass. But I don't use it for several reasons. And the main reason is I'm not in favor of soil testing just for the sake of soil testing. I only soil test when there's an issue I'm trying to diagnose. or if you've had a pre-existing condition and you're just trying to keep track of the number over time or something to see if you can stay above some level that you've, you know, known to be associated with a problem. So I don't use it for that reason, because I don't do a lot of soil testing. But even if I did do soil testing, I still wouldn't use it, because I'm familiar with the literature, and the literature, although it's challenging to, you know, be well versed on it, you have to spend quite a bit of time reading it, and you have to be experienced on how to find these data. The literature will be far more efficient than MLSN. In other words, there's clear examples in literature where if you followed MLSN, you would be over-applying nutrients. And today's paper is a very clear example of that. Whereas the numbers in this particular paper are going to be below MLSN values, which would indicate you would probably need to apply these nutrients, potassium in particular, in this paper. But the paper is going to find that there was no response to potassium. You didn't need to apply potassium, even at numbers well below MLSN. So that's another reason why I don't follow it. But, you know, this is sort of my area of speciality. This is what I do for a living, and I'm fairly knowledgeable on the literature. So I'm comfortable with certain numbers, with certain soil types and certain grasses. I kind of have a general idea of what they are. But if you don't have any of that knowledge, then I would recommend following MLSN, because it's easy to remember and it's probably going to be more efficient for you than following something from a commercial lab. So that's my take on MLSN, if you want to know what it is. So that takes care of my checklist here on my paper. I hope everybody's doing well. This is a fun paper, very easy paper to follow. We're going to get into it. Most of the results I'm going to show in a PowerPoint slide. So let's get into it. Let me see how I want to do this today. Okay. Today's paper is entitled Interrelationships of Among Turf Grasses, Clipping Recycling, Thatch, and Applied Calcium, Magnesium, and Potassium. Published by Sartain in Agronomy Journal in 1993. Now, for those of you who don't know, I got my master's from under Dr. Jerry Sartain at University of Florida in 2001. And then I got my PhD also under Dr. Jerry Sartain in 2004. So I'm very familiar with these papers and the locations and the soils and the personnel that did it and the labs that did it and you name it. I mean, this is my office was 15 feet from him for 6 years or whatever it was, 5 years. And whenever, you know, we get to these papers, these are easier for me to follow because some of these papers I was actually involved with. This particular paper I was not. Anyway, let's get to it. Turf grass clippings are composed of varying quantities of cellulose and lignin, which influence the rate of decomposition. Now, at the time, there was some thought that the return of clippings would contribute to thatch, or the removal of clippings would cause some reduction in turf quality or performance or something, but there wasn't a whole lot of hard data on that. There's a little bit in the literature, but there wasn't a lot. This is in 1993, so they did this work in, you know, a couple years prior. Okay, so this paper is going to contribute to that question, or that was lingering back then. Still lingers today. Potassium is a primary essential nutrient for turf grass production, but in some cases, potassium fertilization has been shown not to influence Bermuda grass growth. This literature that he's going to cite is going to be primarily forage grass literature. Not particularly, that's a problem, but there's not going to be a lot of direct literature to say turf grass as we would maintain it today. There is some, but not a lot. So just keep in mind, he's citing a paper that I believe the Barrios and Jones paper was a forage grass paper, if I'm not mistaken. Oh no, it was Tiff Green. So I'm wrong. That was a tip. No, that was regular grass. I'll have to review that one then. Okay. However, in other studies, Bermuda grass rhizomes, roots, and stand have been positively influenced by potassium applications. Some of this inconsistency in response may be due to the soil potassium status. Bermuda grass disease incidence has been related to tissue potassium concentrations. Midsummer tissue potassium levels of 6% or less were associated with the progressive severity of, I can't even pronounce these pathology names, but Helminthosporium cynodontis. I don't know what that is. So there are cases where the potassium concentration in tissue is both is correlated to disease reduction and disease risk if you're too low or too high. And we'll go into that as we move forward in the channel. A number of fertilizer potassium sources are available in turf grass. Response to the different potassium sources has been evaluated by a number of researchers. G.C. Horn in 1965 reported that potassium sulfate and potassium carbonate were superior potassium fertilizer sources for Bermuda grass. More recently, Snyder and Cesar in 1990 found no response relative to potassium source. And I think that Cesar paper is a, I don't think it's a paper. Let me look down here. I think it's actually a, yeah, it's a technical report. Yeah, so it's not even a refereed paper. So that's what you'll find a lot in these older papers before they, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. A lot of times they'll cite papers that aren't refereed papers, which, you know, it is what it is. Fertilizer with magnesium has been shown to have little effect on the magnesium status of tall fescue, whereas potassium fertilization reduced the tissue calcium and magnesium and increased the potassium concentration. Now, we found that already in one of the papers, I guess it was yesterday, and even in the Miller paper, which I've gone over before, but I'll go over again, I guess, where the application of potassium is going to very likely alter the uptake of other cations, such as calcium and magnesium, which we don't necessarily worry about so much. It's going to reduce it, but generally it's not going to reduce it to the point where it'd be harmful to the turf. But just be aware, it likely will do that. In other cases, it'll reduce the uptake of other cations that we don't necessarily want, such as sodium. If you're in high sodium situations where you're applying a lot of irrigation water with high sodium, and that sodium is resulting in a reduction in turf quality or some other metric that you desire, then the application of potassium has clearly been shown to reduce the concentration of sodium in turf grass tissue. So, and we went over that, I think it was yesterday. Okay. So that would be a benefit if you were in that situation. Interrelationships of the effects of the soil calcium and magnesium on plant growth has been studied on various crops. Lehman, 1984, found the optimum soil calcium magnesium ratio to be 2.5 for tomatoes. Again, not a turf plant, but you'll see that throughout here. Veronin and Bantor, 1985. Failed to obtain a response to herbage growth relative to the soil calcium magnesium status. Bermuda grass growth rate was not reduced in the presence of a 100-to-1 soil extractable calcium to magnesium ratio. So why is Dr. Sertain going over this soil calcium magnesium stuff in this paragraph? He's saying that there was a case with tomatoes where the calcium magnesium ratio mattered. There was a case where they failed to result in a response from calcium magnesium status from another paper, and there was a case where there was the presence of 100-to-1 calcium and magnesium ratio on Bermuda grass did not have an effect on the Bermuda grass. So why is he going over this? The calcium to magnesium ratio topic is a favorite topic of turf grass charlatans and grifters. They love talking about calcium, and they love talking about the ratio of calcium to other elements, because when calcium is high enough, which is probably in 99.99999% of the locations in turf grass settings, when it's high enough, they can't sell any calcium-based products. But when you look at the ratio of calcium to other elements, sometimes they can argue, well, you need to apply more calcium because your magnesium is too high. Or you need to apply more calcium because your potassium is too high. It's out of balance with the other elements. which is complete nonsense. Okay, and the evidence is substantial, refuting that notion. But when they don't have a hook to sell you a product, they try to find a different hook. And the different hook is the ratio of these elements in the soil. So that's why Dr. Sartain is talking about this particular ratio, is because it was discussed even 100 years ago, it was discussed, this ratio of calcium magnesium, the ratio of calcium to the soils. And a lot of people will be convinced that you need to balance the soils, because when they do, they see good turf grass, which is true. They generally will see good turf grass when you do that. But it's not a result of balancing the nutrients. It's a result of simply applying a nutrient that was deficient. And that's one thing that these base saturation people just don't comprehend. They're so indoctrinated and so, you know, dogmatically, you know, positioned on their idea that calcium, magnesium, and calcium balance is important, that they can't think outside their own indoctrination. They're making too much money on it. Well, people are using it and we're seeing good results. Yeah, I know people are using it, and I'm convinced they probably see good results. Okay. But it's not because of the balance, it's because of something else. You're either adjusting the pH and didn't know it, you're applying magnesium or potassium when it was needed, and instead of balancing it with some other element. So in this paper, he's going to talk about calcium and magnesium, and he's going to look at he has another paper, the Sartain 85 paper is actually more specifically tailored to this topic. He cites that in his own paper here. But in this paper as well, he'll look at the calcium-magnesium ratio. And we'll see what he concludes. But that's why he's talking about this ratio, for those people who might not understand or might not know why this is such a big deal, is because so much money is wasted in the turf grass industry by constantly trying to stay on this teeter-totter of calcium, magnesium, potassium, trying to teeter-totter and balance it all out. Because no matter what the amount is in the soil, you can always argue that you need to balance one compared to the other. Even if you have plenty of the magnitude, plenty of the amount in the soil, you could have more than enough. The balance might be off, and so that would be another hook. That's the reason that base saturation salesmen like to use it, because they're just trying to find another angle to sell you something. And in the case of calcium, I dare someone to find me a bona fide response, turf grass response to calcium in the field. Not to pH adjustments, not to gypsum adjusting it because of the sodic soil situation, but to calcium in the field. It's extremely rare. Very, very rare. Okay. So you'll see in this actual, let me see here. I thought there was one little blip on the radar here, but of course there's not. No, there's not. So anyway, let's continue. The purpose of this study was to evaluate the influence of clipping return and potassium, calcium, magnesium application on thatch accumulation, clipping yield, and visual turf quality of TIF wave Bermuda grass and pennant ryegrass. The amendment effects on soil extractable levels of potassium, calcium, magnesium were examined, along with the effects of soil extractable calcium to magnesium ratio on clipping yield. So back in the 80s and 90s, even now occasionally, it's really gone away a lot in North Florida, where it was very prevalent in the 80s and 90s and prior to that, where Bermuda grass fairways were overseeded with ryegrass in North Florida for color. And around, I don't know, probably around 2000, early 2000s and moving forward, the golf courses in those areas have generally moved away from overseeding those fairways and tee boxes with ryegrass. There's still some probably up there that do that, no doubt. But there's not quite as much of that done anymore in North Florida as there was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But that's why he's looking at Bermuda grass and ryegrass in this study, because it was extremely common in North Florida at that time. Studies were initiated in 1985 and conducted over a three-year period at the Turfgrass Field Laboratory near Gainesville, Florida, on an Arredondo loamy fine sand with a pH of 6.3 and a CEC of 11. And this is one thing I'll get into it at some point. I guess I'll get into it today, because this is more of a soil testing paper, or more of a soil testing episode. But a lot of base saturation BS artists, they like to they'll move the goalposts all the time. They'll say, well, it didn't work because of this. It didn't work because of that. And you can't do it on this. And they're always shifting the goalposts left and right, trying to rewrite the rules. And in a lot of times what you'll hear them say is, well, base saturation is not going to work when the CEC is less than some value. Usually it's 7, 8, you know, 9, something like that. Well, of course it's not going to work on soils that have CEC less than, pick a number, 8. If they agree with that, then can we not agree to eliminate all use of base saturation on USGA spec greens or California style greens because all of those CECs are less than 8? So so I'm sure they would agree, right? If they're saying it won't work on less than 8, then let's eliminate all use of base saturation on greens because no greens on USGA spec greens or California style greens are going to have a CEC greater than 8. But even when it is greater than 8, which is what I'm going to show today, and I'll show in the future as well, it still doesn't work. So this soil here had a CEC of 11. Okay, so it's greater than 8. So it should work, right? Balancing this calcium magnesium should work on this soil because the CEC is greater than 8 or 9 or whatever. Maybe now they'll say it has to be greater than 11. You know, they keep moving the number up. they like to move the goalpost all the time. In November in each year, dormant Tifway Bermuda grass was overseeded at a rate of 122 grams per square meter with pennant perennial rye. So that's why I said they overseeded the Bermuda grass. That was very common back in those days. And it's like I said, it still is in some courses in North Florida. Calcium, magnesium, and potassium were applied at 0 and 0.4 pounds every 60 days, so every 2 months, as calcium sulfate, magnesium sulfate, and potassium sulfate, respectively. So for those of you who know my channel and are familiar with what I've discussed with potassium responses and so forth, I've mentioned in the past that you can't really confirm if the response was from potassium if you applied it with potassium sulfate, because sulfate can also induce a turf response. But in this paper, he applied potassium sulfate, calcium sulfate, magnesium sulfate. He's applying these sulfated salts. And so how would he know if the response was actually from calcium if he also applied it with sulfate? Well, this is how he knows. Because the nitrogen was applied uniformly every month using ammonium sulfate at 2 pounds a N. So every month, he applied 2 pounds a N from ammonium sulfate during the growing season. And the sulfate from that ammonium sulfate would basically balance out all the sulfate effect. Right. So the response, hang on one second. I'm sorry. The response or all the plots, including the control, is gonna have sulfate. So the response from potassium would be known at that point. That's the way you would balance that out. And that's what he did. Okay, clippings were removed and discarded from one half of each plot, and clippings were not removed on the other half. So one half so it's a split plot. One half of the plot was the turf grass was remained on the surface, and the other half it was removed. Visual quality ratings were taken every 2 weeks on a 1 to 9 scale, with 5.5 as the minimum acceptable. Visual quality was a composite of turf color, density, uniformity, etc. Soil samples down to 6 inches were taken from each plot in October at termination of the study and extracted with Malic 1 and analyzed for potassium, calcium, magnesium. Now, Malic 1 was common back then. It's common today in many places. The University of Florida Soil Testing Laboratory used Malic 1 up until about 2003 or 4, something like that, and they switched over to Malic 3. I'm going to show a little bit of another two papers to show you my confidence what Malic 1 and Malic 3 will be in this particular paper, because I want to make sure when I'm showing the values that it's relatable to the MLSN, which is on Malic 3, okay? And in fact, why don't I just do that right now, because the next thing is the results and discussion. So everything was taken, the soil test was taken using Malic 1. And what I want to make sure that we're on the same page is in the soil, I know from on this particular soil that there's been a correlation done between Malic 1 and Malic 3, which cannot always, you need to know soil to soil what that is. You can't just convert and say it's 20% higher or 50% higher. And you definitely can't do it when you go from the Malix into the Olsons, into the Brays, and these other things. You can't just do a percentage increase. There's a lot more information you need to know. But on this soil, I am pretty confident that the potassium value is going to be extremely close to what the Malic 1 was when you, if you had used Malic 3, maybe a little bit higher with Malic 3. And even the magnesium is going to be very close. So why am I convinced, or why am I confident that that is actually the case? Because there have been correlations done on this particular soil. And if you go to the, let me see if I can fix this. This has bugged me for quite a while over here on this thing here. Hang on one second. Let me, can't seem to ever fix this. Don't know why. Maybe today's not the day either. Okay, hang on. Now I got it. Sorry, for those listening, I'm just fidgeting with something on the screen here that's just been bugging me for days and I can't ever seem to fix it. So, okay. The UF IFAS Extension published a paper, SL407, and it's entitled Extraction of Soil Nutrients Using Malic 3 Reagent for Acidic Mineral Soils of Florida. You can go download this for free on their website or just Google it. It'll pop right up. And it was by Malavar Poo, Tom Abriza, Kelly Morgan, George Hockmuth, and Alan Wright. I know all these except for Vimalar. Alan and Kelly graduated with me at UF. Tom Abriza was the dean there for ages. Rao was the charge of the soil testing lab, and George was maybe still is a professor. I don't know if he's retired yet. Anyway, so in this paper, we're going to scroll down to a couple of graphs. Remember, the reason I'm doing this is because I want to make sure that when I'm talking the potassium in this paper that I'm talking about, it is relatable, even though it's Malic 1, it is relatable to Malic 3. And the reason I'm convinced that that's the case is because of this particular chart or this particular correlation where we have Malic 1 on the x-axis and Malic 3 on the y-axis. And he gives me the equation. I know this particular soil, this particular correlation was done on like around 500 soils, acidic mineral soils in Florida. And we see the equation is 1 times the Malic 1 value plus 0.93. So if the value of Malic 1 is 10, you multiply it by 1, which is 10, and you add 0.93, which is essentially 11. So if it's Malic 1 on these soils, the Malic 3 would be about 11. Okay. With magnesium, the soil magnesium value is the Malic 1. Here's the magnesium. I'm looking down here on another chart, same sort of correlation graph. The magnesium of Malic 1 times 1.01, which is basically the same. So if it was 10, it would be 10. And then plus 0.63, which would be 10.63. So let's just say 11. So roughly speaking, it's essentially the same value as the Malic 1 on this soil, on these soils. That's the reason I'm convinced that a Malic 1, in this case, I can easily say Malic 3 would be about 11 if it was 10. It's basically the same number. But if that doesn't convince you, there's actually a stronger publication that was published in Farming Systems in 2023, the journal Farming Systems. And it was published also, Kelly Morgan's also on this paper. He's, I don't know where he's at. I guess he's over in Hastings or maybe, I don't know where he's at anymore, but I thought he was in South Florida for a while. But anyway, he has another number of authors on this paper. And the title is Evaluate the Use of Malic 3 Compared to Malic 1 as a Soil Test in Northeast Florida. Now, Hastings area, I'm also familiar with. I've driven through that area of Florida hundreds and hundreds of times. It's between Gainesville and Crescent Beach where I'd go surfing or fishing. And in here, they also have some equations. Now, this particular paper is also on the acidic sandy soils of Florida, and the equations for potassium and magnesium are also on this paper. And the R squared is on this paper too. The R squared with potassium between Malic 1 and Malic 3 is 0.98 in one soil, 0.97 in another location, and 0.97 in the other location. You'll see the equation is essentially the same. It's Malic 1 times 1.3 plus 3 in one soil or plus 4 in another soil, and then the other one's basically the same. So roughly speaking, Malic 1 is going to be anywhere between the exact same number, which would be 10 and 10, or maybe as high as, 13 or 14 if it was a Malic 3 number. And the only reason I'm harping on all that and spending so much time on that is because the values in this paper are so far below MLSN, and yet there was no response to it. Well, MLSN was on Malic 3. right? And this is on Malik 1. One could argue that they don't line up. But what I'm arguing is I'm convinced that even if it was Malik 3, it's only going to be slightly higher than Malik 1. Therefore, I can make that relationship, or I can make that comparison, I should say. Okay, so on to the results and discussion. No interaction effect of treatments in years were observed. Therefore, means of the measure parameters over the three-year study are presented. So you're not going to see what happened in year one, year two, year three. They just pooled them across years because there were no interactions. Mean clipping yield of both Bermuda grass and ryegrass was increased by the return of clippings. Bermuda grass and ryegrass clipping yield was increased by 27 and 20% respectively by the return of clippings. So I'm just going to, you know what, let me just skip to the PowerPoint, and then I'll come back to this because I think this is going to be a little bit easier to see in the PowerPoint anyway. So let me go to PowerPoint and see if I can get this here. So, I'll get back. That was the scoreboard. I'll get to the scoreboard at the end. So here's the effect of clipping removal on clipping yield. So I'm looking at a graph here on a PowerPoint slide where it has Bermuda grass and ryegrass on the x-axis, and then clipping yields on the y-axis. And it's the effect, it's basically going to say, what is the effect of removing the clippings versus returning the clippings? Because we've always heard that, right? We've heard, well, you should return the clippings. You should return the clippings. And this is epistemology, so I would ask, well, how do you know? Well, it just makes sense that, you know, returning the clippings have nutrients in them, and we don't want to remove those. We want to return them. Well, I agree that does make sense, but that's a horrible reason. So how do you know? And actually, this is not, let me fix this real quick. This is not the right citation. Let me remove that before I get too far. But just because it sounds good, or that's the first thing that came to your mind, is not a good reason to engage in a management practice. Okay. You could be wrong. And I'll go into that. There's a book, it's either an article or a book called The Mass Delusion and the Psychology of Delusions and the Psychology of Mass Crowds, or something like that. The Mass Delusion and the Psychology of Crowds. Someone can Google it and pull it up. But people can be deceived by their senses. There was a case in Spain in, I think it was 1905 or 1910. I'll have to bring it up one time at some point on the channel, where hundreds and hundreds, there's photographs of this, by the way, and there's articles, hundreds and hundreds of people witnessed the sun splitting and two different suns appearing in the sky. Hundreds observed this. Okay. And there's photographs of these people up there watching it. Now, were they correct? Obviously not. If there were two suns in the sky, it would be throw the whole solar system out of whack, right? But they are convinced that that's what they saw. You couldn't convince them otherwise, right? And the point is, when I'm using that, is that people can be convinced even from their observations, especially because of their observations, and their observations can be wrong. And so when it comes to clipping yields, if you say we should return clippings because I've seen it before, I've applied clippings, and that's the reason we should return clippings. And they have nutrients in them, and that makes sense. We should return them. All those are horrible reasons, or bad reasons, guys. They're availability heuristics. You know, they're post-hoc agropropter hoc fallacies, where you did this and saw that, and therefore it must have happened. Those are all bad reasons. Okay, believe it or not, those are not good reasons. What is a good reason? This is a good reason to believe that. The effect of clipping removal on clipping yield. When you use Bermuda grass or you use ryegrass and you return the clippings or you remove the clippings, what happens to the clipping yield, the actual growth of the grass? And we see that the growth of the grass is increased following the return of the clippings. So each on this graph, any bar under the same line is the same. So if you have two different bars, like for example, Bermuda grass here, when the clippings were returned, the clipping yield was 5.1 grams per square meter, and when they were removed, the clipping yield was 4.2. So you saw a reduction of about, whatever, 15% or so, 20%, when you removed the clippings. With ryegrass, it went from 4 to 3.5, so again, about a 15 or 20% reduction in clipping yield when the clippings were removed. Okay. So that's a good reason. If you want to enhance the growth of your grass, that's a good reason to return the clippings. Let's look what happens on the effect of clipping removal on clipping nitrogen content. So the actual content of the clippings themselves, when they were returned to the plots versus when they were removed from the plots, what happened to the nitrogen content in the clippings? Bermuda grass is on the, and ryegrass are on the x-axis, and grams of nitrogen per square meter every 3 days is on the y-axis. And again, we see when the nitrogen, when the clippings were returned, the nitrogen from Bermuda grass was around 603 grams of nitrogen per square meter, and it dropped down to about 500 or so, a little less than 500. And they were significantly different, both statistically and biologically. And on ryegrass, the nitrogen content when the clippings were returned, it was 834 compared to 563 when they were removed. So again, you're seeing a significant reduction in the nitrogen in the clippings themselves when you remove the clippings off the plot. So leave the clippings on the plot. That's what's going to help you in terms of your growth and help you in terms of the nitrogen content in the clippings. Those are good reasons. Let's look at the effect of clipping removal on turf quality. So this is, in my view, the one of the more important metrics, because this is the metric that Miss Jones is looking at when she looks out her kitchen window. This is what the golf pro is looking at when he's playing golf. He wants to know, how is it performing? What does it look like? The coaches care about the performance, but they also care about the quality. What does the field look like? How's it playing? So this is why I put so much importance on turf grass quality as a metric to use. So we have Bermuda grass and ryegrass again, and turf grass quality on 1-9 on the y-axis. And we see Bermuda grass, the quality was reduced from 7.1 to 6.8. I would argue that's probably biologically insignificant, but there was a statistical reduction. And in ryegrass, there was no reduction in turf quality when the clippings were removed. Okay, in this paper, Dr. Sartain actually says that the only disadvantage from returning the clippings was that there were some clippings visible on the grass, and so therefore that would not be acceptable for putting greens, which I agree. But that was the only disadvantage to returning clippings, that there was a little bit of clippings on the grass for a day or two. So for putting greens, this would not be acceptable. But we don't see a very significant increase by returning the clippings. But there is, over 3 years, the average was a little bit higher when the clippings were returned with Bermuda grass. But there was no difference when the clippings were returned for ryegrass. Okay? So let's look at turf grass clippings affected by the applied calcium and magnesium. So now we're going to be looking at the clipping weight, the dry weight, the growth of the grass, basically, as they were influenced by the application of calcium, magnesium, and potassium. Okay, now this particular graph was pooled across clipping returns because there was no interaction. The same occurred whether you return clippings or didn't return clippings. The same effect occurred on clipping yields following the application of calcium, magnesium, potassium. But let's look and see what happened when we applied calcium, magnesium, or potassium to Bermuda grass and ryegrass in North Florida over 3 years. We find that there were no differences in calcium. Calcium did not change the clipping weight in Bermuda grass, and it did not change the clipping weight in ryegrass. So calcium had no effect. But magnesium did have an effect. Magnesium had an effect on Bermuda grass. It went up from 4 to 5 in terms of dry weight. And potassium had an effect on Bermuda grass, going up from 4.2 to 4.8 on dry weight on Bermuda grass. But there was never an effect of calcium, magnesium, or potassium on ryegrass, on clippings. Okay. So clipping weight was not influenced on ryegrass by the application of calcium, magnesium, or potassium. But with Bermuda grass, magnesium and potassium resulted in an increase in clipping weights, but not with calcium. As soon as I get through this, I'll go back and I'll show the soil test values of all of these elements so you know where they started from. So now we're going to look at turf grass quality effect by applied calcium, magnesium, and potassium when clippings were removed. So So there was no effect on the turfgrass quality following the application of calcium, magnesium, potassium when clippings were not removed. He states that in the text. But when clippings were removed, there was a little bit of an effect. So we're looking at Bermuda grass and ryegrass on the x-axis with calcium, magnesium, potassium, and turfgrass quality on the y-axis. And we're applying 0 pounds of calcium or 0.4 pounds of calcium every 60 days, every 2 months. Okay. And same thing goes with magnesium, 0 or 0.4 pounds, potassium, 0 or 0.4 pounds every 2 months. 0.4 pounds per 1,000 square feet. And we see that calcium had no effect when clippings were removed with Bermuda grass. Calcium had no effect when clippings were removed with ryegrass. So calcium had no effect, whether they were removed or returned. However, magnesium actually did result in an increase from 7 to 7.2 when magnesium was applied. So when magnesium was applied, when the clippings were removed, and magnesium was applied, the quality went from 7 to 7.2. Biologically, you'd never see that, but statistically, they saw a response. And we're here today because of potassium. And even when the clippings were removed, the turf quality did not change following the application of potassium, 0.4 pounds of potassium every 2 months with Bermuda grass, and it did not change with ryegrass. With potassium. The only thing that went up was the quality went up a little bit, biologically an insignificant level, but it went up when magnesium was applied. That's the only element that actually showed a positive response, but it was only on turf grass where the grass was removed. Okay, what did not occur when the turf grass clippings remained on the plots. Okay. So let's go look at the actual soil test values that existed on these plots. So I will just give me 1 second. 1 second, guys. You know. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so now let's look at the soil test value. So we found that magnesium resulted in an increase in turf grass quality only when clippings were removed. Potassium never did, and calcium never did. So let's look and see what the initial soil test levels were. So here on this table on the left here, let's see if I can get this on here without getting it off screen. Yeah, okay, this will work. So on this table, Malick 1 extractable soil levels of calcium, magnesium, potassium at termination of the study in response to applied nutrients. And on here, you're going to have a row where no calcium, no magnesium, and no potassium was applied. So this is what existed in the soil with nothing being applied. And the Malick 1 extractable calcium was 456, magnesium was 20, and the potassium was 10. So this goes back to what I was saying when we're converting to Malick 3 in this case. If the potassium was 10, at most, Malick 3 might be 13 or 14, but it's probably close to 10. And magnesium at most might be 25-ish, maybe, but it's probably close to 20 because we know these two elements are very closely correlated between Malick 1 and Malick 3. The correlation is very close and the values are essentially the same. So in cases where the Malick 3 potassium on Bermuda grass and on ryegrass in North Florida, where the Malick 3 or Malick 1 potassium was around 10, they applied potassium and they didn't see a response. They removed the clippings and they applied potassium and they didn't see a response. Okay? So, for that reason, among many other reasons, I follow this. I will follow these results, these conclusions, because they will result in a more efficient usage of potassium than another soil test interpretation. If you followed MLSN, MLSN is, I don't know what the potassium is, 37, I think. You very likely would have believed that you need to apply potassium because the value of 10 is 1/3 or 1/4 almost of the quote unquote minimum level sustainable nutrition. And yet the turf quality never changed following the application of potassium. Magnesium did change. Oh, maybe I misspoke earlier. I'm sorry if I said something about magnesium. Magnesium quality did go up, but only when clippings were removed. When the clippings were returned, there was never a response to magnesium. So that indicates, you can infer from that or deduce from that, that that value of 20, where no potassium was applied at all, when you apply tissue to it, when you leave the tissue there, there is no response. So that 20 is probably right on that line. Because when the clippings were removed and there was no additional magnesium coming from the clippings, right, the return of the clippings, then you applied magnesium and you saw a response. So somewhere around that 20 number in this particular location is probably where the minimum level is. And I have no idea what the MLSN magnesium minimum level is. But you see my point is that because I'm familiar with the literature, I wouldn't use MLSN because it's going to result in me applying nutrients that I don't need, at least in this case. Okay. I don't see the value in applying nutrients that I don't need or are not going to result in a response that I desire. And following this particular paper and other papers similar, there's other papers similar to this, I feel confident that this would result in a more efficient usage of nutrients, okay, than some other soil testing interpretation. Okay, so let me read through the text just real quick. I've pretty much gone over everything in those graphs. But let me just read through, make sure I didn't miss anything. Ryegrass quality was unaffected by clipping return. The weight loss on ignition was not increased by the return of ryegrass clippings. So the clippings did not affect thatch really at all. Overall, the mean weight loss on ignition was not influenced by clipping returns. So thatch was not affected by clipping returns. The addition of potassium and calcium did not promote additional thatch accumulation. Magnesium did, I think, he concluded, but that's probably due to a little bit of an increased growth right here. Yeah, application of magnesium from which the clippings were removed increased quantity of thatch, right? The effect of magnesium addition on thatch may have been a result of increased growth. So that's probably true. Turfgrass clipping yield, nitrogen content of clippings, and visual quality were influenced positively by the return of clippings. This is why this is a good reason to return clippings. Not because you saw it, not because someone said it, not because it makes sense, but because we have concluded through numerous papers, the scientific process has determined and concluded that there's a very good probability that you're going to result in better turfgrass and fewer need of applying nutrients if you return the clippings than if you remove the clippings. That's a good reason. No increased incidence of diseases or insects were noted on plots receiving clippings. In fact, no disadvantages were observed other than the presence of clippings on the plots, which would mean that putting greens would not be practical. The soil was low in extractable magnesium and potassium and had a final pH of 5.0. Application of magnesium reduced the level of extractable calcium. When calcium and magnesium were both applied, the soil extractable level of calcium remained about the same as the untreated soil, and magnesium increased the level to that of magnesium only treatment. It appears that magnesium was retained in preference to calcium and that the applied calcium was lost through leaching when magnesium was applied. So what that's saying basically is when you're applying calcium, you're applying magnesium, you're applying potassium to the soil, you're going to affect other cations in the soil. You're going to knock them off exchange sites, or you're going to be taken up in the plant preferentially because you're applying a nutrient, and through mass action, you're just going to have more of that potassium available or soluble, and it's going to change the concentration of other elements in the plant and the soil. That happens all the time. Calcium, magnesium, all those things. So be careful. You don't really want to do that unless you have a good reason to apply that element. In the case of calcium, I dare someone to find me a good reason to apply calcium, not gypsum in the case of sodic soils, not lime in the case of moving pH up, but calcium. Send it to me. There's a bona fide response, turfgrass response to calcium. Show me that, and I'll read it on site, on the channel, no problem. He goes through a couple other things here, mostly the soil-related stuff. They're kind of important. Let me just read through here quickly. The influence of calcium leaching was even stronger when potassium was applied along with magnesium. Reduced levels of soil extractable calcium were observed when potassium was applied. This reduction was amplified when magnesium was applied with calcium. Soil magnesium was influenced by the application of calcium and potassium, but the addition of calcium and magnesium, or both along with potassium, tended to reduce the soil extractable potassium status. Which, you know, you're applying more calcium, or you're applying more cations, you're going to reduce another cation. The divalent nature of calcium and magnesium possibly resulted in greater retention of these nutrients at the expense of potassium. That has to do with the different types of charges on the elements. It appears that from the results that when applied in combination with magnesium, when applied in combination, magnesium will be retained more effectively. Essentially, none of the applied calcium was retained when applied with magnesium and calcium. In fact, the soil extractable calcium status of the plots receiving all three nutrients was actually less than the untreated plots, suggesting that rather large amounts of calcium had been lost from these plots over the three-year period of study, and yet there still was no response in calcium. They're reducing the calcium concentration in the plots by applying magnesium and potassium, but yet there still was no response to calcium. Mean malic 1 and extractable potassium increased from 10 to 39 parts per million potassium. So mean malic 1 extractable potassium increased from 10 to 39 malic 1 over the three-year period in response to the applied potassium. This Arredondo soil was composed of 96% sand, and the potential for creating potassium reserves was small. Based on current interpretations, this soil contains from low to medium levels of malic 1 extractable potassium for turf grass production. Remember, it moved up from 10 to 39, but there was still no turf grass quality response. So it didn't matter. The ratio of malic 1 extractable levels of calcium to magnesium varied from 3 to 49 across different treatments by the end of the study. Remember, in a previous study, which I haven't gone over yet, but I will, it varied to 100. In this case, it was from 3 to 49, the calcium-magnesium ratio. No relationship was observed between the clipping yield and visual quality of either turf grass and the calcium-to-magnesium ratio of the soil. Yet applications of magnesium increased visual quality and clipping yields. This is in agreement with findings reported in other studies. Therefore, the maintenance of a target calcium to magnesium ratio in a turf grass soil is of little value. Maintenance of certain minimum levels of soil extractable calcium magnesium may be a more practical importance. He says it right there. It's in red. You're going to see this at least another 10 times. I could probably show you another 50 publications, not just with turf grass, but with other crops, where it's going to say the same thing. Therefore, the maintenance of a target calcium to magnesium ratio is of little value, and maintaining certain minimum levels is of more practical importance. So if you're chasing balancing numbers on a soil test, what this is saying is you're not following the evidence. The more practical importance would be just to maintain a certain minimum level, target level or level of the actual concentration in the soil. The application of calcium, magnesium, and potassium did not influence ryegrass clipping yields, so potassium didn't influence it. Bermuda grass clipping yield was, however, increased by the application of potassium. Ryegrass clipping yield was not influenced by potassium, magnesium, or calcium. Bermuda grass was influenced by the application of potassium and magnesium. This supports the interpretation of the soil test analysis for these two elements. So that's what this was right here. Magnesium and potassium, I showed that. Magnesium and potassium, the clipping dry weight was increased with Bermuda grass, but not the quality, but the clipping weight was. Okay? Only on Bermuda grass, not on rye grass. All right, last two or three paragraphs here. The visual quality of turf grass growing on plots to which the clippings were returned was not influenced by the applied nutrients. I want to make sure that's clear. The visual quality of both turf grasses, where there was calcium, magnesium, or potassium applied, when the clippings were returned, neither calcium, magnesium, or potassium resulted in an increase in quality at very low levels of potassium and magnesium. It was a 10 on a malic one potassium, and a 20 on magnesium, and 456 on calcium, which is also considered sometimes low. Very low levels, and when the clippings were returned, we didn't see a response to applying those nutrients. Application of magnesium did positively influence the appearance of both turf grasses growing on plots from which the clippings were removed. Limiting supplies of soil magnesium, especially on plots having very low magnesium levels of 14 to 18 parts per million, were possibly augmented by the applied magnesium, which resulted in a higher visual quality. So that's, you know, when the clippings were removed, they augmented that application, they applied magnesium, and they saw a response. So when the clippings were returned, even on low magnesium soils, clippings were returned, they applied magnesium, they didn't see a response. It's only when they were removed. So that's the reason I'm saying that line at like 20 Malic 1 or, you know, 20 to 25 Malic 3 is probably the line for magnesium for these turf grasses in this location. In summary, the return of clippings does not appear to negatively impact Tifway Bermuda grass. In fact, clipping yield and visual quality are enhanced by their return. Potassium and magnesium addition promotes clipping yield while depleting soil extractable calcium reserves. Bermuda grass and perennial ryegrass will tolerate a wide range in soil to calcium ratios, soil calcium to magnesium ratios without exhibiting detrimental effects. So that's the short and skinny. The conclusion is basically when clippings were returned to Bermuda grass and to ryegrass on soils that were low in potassium, consider low in potassium, consider low in magnesium, and then we applied potassium, when we applied magnesium, there was no response. When we removed the clippings, magnesium resulted in a response, but potassium still didn't. In terms of quality, potassium still did not increase the turf grass quality, even on low K soils, even when turf grass clippings were removed. Okay, potassium still didn't result in a response. So mark this down in the column on the scoreboard for no response. They did not show any negative responses to potassium in this paper. So this will be one paper. There's nothing in the negative column. So let's just do that real quick before I forget. So let's go to let's go back to the PowerPoint, and I'll put this on the scoreboard here. So the scoreboard has Malic 1 at potassium at 10 parts per million, remember. And I'm going to put in here, positive response, none. And negative response, none. Where's my marker here? Can't seem to find it. Okay. This is Sartain. What was that? I can't remember the year on that. 1993. Sartain, 1993. So to potassium, I thought there was an increase in clipping. I mean, I thought there was like, didn't potassium increase clipping yields briefly? Yeah. So it did increase the clipping yields. So if you want to, so let me put it in the positive as well, because clipping yields, I mean, maybe you want to increase the growth. I mean, you could argue that increasing clipping yields would be a negative. I don't know really how to put that. Should clipping yield increase? Well, it's even on this one. The Waddington and the Ebden was on yield. The positive responses that I put in that column were Ebden 2013 was yield. The Waddington 1972 was on yield. And the Sartain 93 was on yield. There hasn't been a response yet that we've noted that was on turf quality, a positive response on turf quality. There's been negative responses on turf quality, and there's been mostly no responses on turf quality. But there have been three that I've noted so far that were potassium did result in an increase in yield. So I would imagine if you're on a sport turf field, you would probably want that. You'd probably want the grass to be growing as fast as it can. But if you're on a home lawn and you're mowing the grass as well as applying the nutrients, or if you're on a, you know, fairway or a rough or something, you might not want a lot of yield. So I guess it's just going to depend on the location and the setting that you're in, whether or not yield is a positive attribute to the application of potassium. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me go. Let me see, where am I at here? Okay, let me go back to the chat here. Brady's in the center of Ohio. Supposed to be thousands of people coming to the area. Brady, you shouldn't have told me that, man. I can't find a hotel. Can I like park a tent in your yard or something? Because I've been looking for like a hotel or an Airbnb or something like that to actually find a place to stay. And I can't. So I was going to go west of Louisville, but I can't find any hotels in the path of the eclipse. So you might find a, if you see a tent in your backyard, don't come shooting. It might be me. Samuel Asamoah, my Bermuda growing on red clay, and I sank a borehole with high amounts of sodium and chlorine with a pH of 5.6. The EC of the water is 1779 microsiemens per centimeter dioxide. Do I have to be concerned about using? I guess the text got cut off, Samuel. I'm not sure what you're asking there, but it sounds like you have a lot of salt. I can't tell from that question, Samuel. I'm sorry, I can't read the rest of it, but I'm not a salt expert, but I'd have to do the conversion. I can't ever remember the conversions between microsiemens per centimeter and you know, the various salinity numbers, but it seems that that might be something you want to look at. Send me an email with more information if you want some help, Samuel, and maybe I can point you in the right direction. Oh, do you have any concerns about using, I'm sorry, it's hard to read this, using water for irrigation. Sorry for digressing. I can't ever remember the conversions to, I can't ever remember the conversions in salinity. It's microsiemens per centimeter. That sounds incredibly high. But I don't want to say yes or no until, let me look at that. I don't want to give you the wrong answer, but that sounds incredibly high to me. But shoot that to me, just send me an email so I don't forget, and I'll see if I can reply back to you and give you some pointers on how to convert. I need to put that in my language. Microsiemens per centimeter, I can't remember if that's the unit that I recall using. But anyway, send me an email so I don't forget. And Dice Cut. Okay, that's an interesting name. Does clipping yield correlate with both vertical and lateral growth? Clipping yield correlate with vertical and lateral growth. I don't know if I've ever seen a number on that. There's going to be, this is just my opinion, and I can't pull up a paper off the top of my head, but when clipping yield increases, it's like, say we're moving into the summer now, or we're moving into the spring now for cool season grasses, my lawn's starting to grow. So yes, I mean, the clipping yields are going to go up as vertical growth goes up on my tall fescue. Tall fescue is going to grow up. It's not going to grow laterally. So as it grows up in the spring, like it is right now, the clipping yields are also going to go up. With lateral growth, like say Bermuda grasses or bluegrasses or something like that, again, the clipping yields are going to go up as the season moves into the spring, and the lateral growth is also going to go up. So just, I can't show you a number on it if you're looking for a number, but I would say, yes, there's a correlation between clipping yields and lateral and vertical growth, depending on the type of, turf you have. Okay. So I will let you guys go. What is today? Wednesday? So I'll be back on Thursday night. Thursday night at 9 p.m. will be the next live show, and then I'll be releasing videos throughout the week that have already been recorded. Okay, guys, appreciate everybody showing up. I'll see you Thursday night. Until then, be kind. Ciao.